Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick and Casey. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on Spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com.
I can't remember the ones I always did. I did armies, citizens,
join the cult! Join the cult of the Spoilerverse, and welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Kenneth Cregan, that's Mr. Horsley, and today on the show, well, it's writer, producer, physicist, publisher, atheist, D&D DM, entrepreneur, father, president, and COO at Top Cow. That's right, folks. Matt Hawkins.
That is such the intro. I love it.
Yeah, man. I have to thank Matt himself because it's right on his Twitter bio. And that's perfect. That makes my life so much easier.
Yeah, it makes people it way don't easier understand for us to do that. So thank you, Matt.
Yeah. Sometimes our intros just suck because I get like, I start going in and I start reading about them and then I overthink it and then it goes to shit. And then other times it's on point. You know what I mean? Yeah. Where I'm trying to figure out how to do things. And I try to introduce people on not necessarily the newest thing that they're doing.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
People have history and it's important.
Yeah, a little bit of, like things that you're not like, oh, okay, yeah, that's funny. But man, when they have it set up like that, you just knock it out of the park.
It's great. You know, it's funny. I think Matt Hawkins was, I'm pretty sure this was a rescheduled one we did. And then Casey do this one for us? I think Casey did, because I don't know.
Man, you should know this. We're setting up the interview.
I'm trying to. So I have a point. I have a point here. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is the original interview was actually scheduled the night before one of the last conventions that have happened since COVID.
Yeah.
We were supposed to talk to him at like, I think it was like 8 o'clock our time. So like 11 o'clock Eastern time for C2E2 in Chicago. And he was all ready to go. And we're like, dude, it's 11 o'clock. You just flew in. Go to bed. And we rescheduled it, and then obviously the world blew up, and you know, then it became easier to schedule things. I'm not sure what the point there was, besides just saying the fact that we were supposed to talk to him before C2E2 and point out the convention. But there you go.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to listen to this interview. Casey did do the interview with Matt. It's going to be a lot of fun. People who don't know, Matt is, well, he's been with Top Cow since like 1998, and he is the COO and he is the president. And they have, and he was there during the inception, or he's one of the original OG creators within Image.
Yeah.
And so he's been a very big deal for a long time in the comic book industry. We're very excited to get into this. Let's just sit back and listen to Matt in his own words.
All right, everybody, welcome again to another episode of Spoiler Country. My name is Casey Allen, and today we are talking to writer, editor, COO, Matt Hawkins. Matt Hawkins, how you doing, man?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
So you wear a lot of hats, a ton of hats.
Yes, for sure.
What's your favorite hat to wear?
I now, as I've gotten older, I prefer the creative side of the business. I like and enjoy the writing part. It is fun for me, and I look forward to it. The business lost its appeal to me a generation ago almost, but I still do it because I'm good at it. And I think being a creative that understands how to market yourself, I think is a very valuable tool because the vast majority of them don't.
I was talking to Kate Leth a few weeks ago, and one thing that she brought up was when she was in art school, she was like, you're not telling us how to sell this shit. Like, right. Nobody is teaching us anything about how the business side works, and that's what we need.
Right.
So
that is for sure. And, you know, it's that whole right brain, left brain thing. And, you know, there's very few creatives that cross over and do both creative and business. It's there's only like five or six of us total in the entire industry.
Do you mind shouting out any other fellow people?
Jim Kruger, Jim Zub.
Jim Zub is awesome.
Chris Ryle. Not very many. I mean, that have had like actual jobs at different. Kurt Busiek ran the, he was in the marketing department in Marvel in the 80s. I think so was Mark Waid, actually. But
Peter David also was in, I think, sales or marketing. I forget, yeah. But he was able to kind of utilize the numbers that he had access to while he was writing. So he can kind of go like, how's this going?
Right.
So he could figure out like, maybe I need to change some stuff up right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So how does a guy that thinks, you know, it, that can exist in both worlds, how does he end up in comics?
My origin story, as I like to call it, is very different from most, because most people, when they talk about how they broke into comics, they go into the story about how they were a lifelong fan. They did this, they did that. I did not read comics when I was a kid, and I didn't really read them as an adult at all. First comic I ever read that was like a real comic book was Brigade Number 2 when I had started working for Extreme Studios back in 93. And then I found, you know, the good stuff and was able to find what comics really appealed to me. And that's the Alan Moore and that kind of stuff. But no, I was going to college full time. I was working at a bank. I was working on my physics degree, which is about as foreign from comic book publishing as you can get. And my dad was an engineer for the military. My sister was also in the military. So I was planning on going into research science. And it did not happen. Working retail banking really sucks, and I hated it. So when my nephew, who's 13 years younger than me, asked me to take him to get his book signed by Rob Liefeld at Maha Comics, I said, okay. I took him. It was on a Saturday. And we waited in a three-hour line. I didn't know who Rob Liefeld was. I didn't know what Image Comic was. I knew what Marvel and DC Comics were, but that was about it. And three guys happened to be right in front of me in the line, and that was Marlo Alkiza, John Sabal, and Cedric Nocon. And you might recognize those names, as two of them are anchors and one of them is a penciler that has worked off and on in comics for the last 28 years. And so those three guys all had their portfolios and were in the line in Anaheim right in front of me.
Oh, wow. So they were just getting started themselves then.
Yeah. They hadn't even been hired yet. They were also in the line to get books signed. And they had their portfolios. And for 3 hours while I waited in this goddamn line, I remember my nephew was restless. And I was talking to these guys because I just was bored. And they were telling me all about Image Comics and what it meant and who Rob Liefeld was, and blah, 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 so on and so forth. So I got sort of an education on the industry of what Image Comics was by the time I got up and I was standing in front of Rob Liefeld. Now, the thing is, when we got up to the front, they were in a separate area. So you came around this corner, and then suddenly there were these eight guys all in these black leather jackets that said Extreme Studios on the back. And there were half a dozen really cute girls with them. And I had been working in retail banking. I was 21, 22, and I was just studying full time, working full time. And I kind of hated my life. And I did not like the job that I had, because like I said, retail banking really fucking sucks. And I did not like the people I worked with. I didn't like the people I worked for. I worked for a company called Norwest Financial at the time, which is now a division of Wells Fargo. But long story short, Rob hired those three guys right in front of me, like hired all three of them on the spot after looking at their portfolios. And I saw 1, 2, 3 get hired. I was the fourth guy. And I'm like, hey, that's great. What else are you looking for? You know, I can't draw, but you looking for anybody to do anything else? And Rob was like, without a beat, he's like, we really need somebody that can write press releases and do letters pages. Is that something you could do? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, okay. And he gave me his card, said, call me tomorrow. So I went to Crown Books. I bought a book on how to write a press release. And I wrote a press release as if I was going to be sending it out for that signing for them to local LA Times or whatever. I faxed it to Rob later that night. I went in the following day on my lunch break from the bank, and he hired me on the spot. And he was annoyed that I insisted on putting in my 2 weeks. You know, none of the guys at Early Extreme or anything had really any concept of what it meant to have like a real job. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
Rob had drawn for Marvel for a number of years, but he was only 22 or 23 as well. And because I think he's only a year or two older than me. I just turned 50. I think he's 52. But, and so you know, the next day I went in, he, like I said, he wanted me to start immediately and at 9 to 5 kind of thing. And I was like, nah, I gotta put in my 2 weeks at this other job. I've been there for over a year. And he didn't seem to understand the concept of that, but I talked him into it. A couple of the guys there said, no, that's what normal people do. And so he's like, oh, okay. So I put in my 2 weeks at the bank. And then after the bank, I would drive over to the Extreme Studios offices and I would work until midnight with those guys. And they all usually work pretty late. So, and then I went to San Diego. That was April of 93. In July of 93 was my first San Diego Comic-Con. And this will be the first year I've missed San Diego Comic-Con in since then because they canceled it. So I
Yeah, it's the first year for everybody.
Yeah. But, and then, you know, I kind of fell in love with it. It was really fun. There was a lot of travel involved. It was exciting. It was interesting. We were meeting famous people. I mean, I remember my third day at Extreme Studios, Tom Cruise walked through the office with Rob. And people don't understand the early days of Extreme. Rob was, and he is now. I mean, he was very well known in the Hollywood circles, and people, they liked him. You know, I mean, I know there are people in comics that didn't like Rob, but Rob was liked, and he's still liked by a lot of that Hollywood sort of people, and he kind of gets them and talks to them in their language, and he was always really good at that. Because I got to tell you, I met Jim Cameron, I met Steven Spielberg, I met Tom Cruise, I met a half a dozen other really famous directors and actors because Rob was just giving them a tour of the early Extreme offices. You know, now I see him on the convention circuit, you know, and sometimes we know each other by name. Like it is one of my favorite things that Henry Winkler knows my name. I really like that, you know, the Fonz. And because he just does so many of these conventions and I'm always in the green room eating lunch and he just sees me at half a dozen of these things. And there was one show he and I were in that was a small show, and it was like him and 3 Power Rangers. They were the only actual celebrities there. But and we kind of bonded. I think it was in like Lexington, Virginia or Lexington, Kentucky or one of those. But anyway, so that's go ahead.
Have you seen that show he's on HBO?
Gary? God, I can't.
Yes. Oh, my God. That show was amazing.
I know of it. It is on my list to watch. I have not watched it.
Like, seriously, when you have a break in things to do and obligations or whatever, check that show out. It is very well done. I was amazed at how I didn't know what to expect going in, and both seasons were amazing.
Cool. I can't wait to check it out. I've been rewatching all the Star Treks, and I finally got to, I haven't watched Picard yet, but I've been watching Enterprise, which I'd never watched before, and I'm surprised actually at how much I like it.
Yeah,
I
remember
trying to watch it when it came out, but the one thing about that show that sucks is the theme song is god awful. It is not a Star Trek theme song. It sounds like a 70s love song, and I'm like, what the fuck is this? They're doing this for a Star Trek theme song. And I remember when it first came out, I didn't watch it for that reason. I remember, and me and several of my buddies talked about, have you heard that stupid theme song? But anyway, so.
Yeah. I just remember the Quantum Leap guy and being disappointed he never got to go home at the end of the series. So.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, you spoilers, dude. Come on. I did not know that.
No, I was making a Quantum Leap joke. The captain. Bad joke.
I get you.
It was terrible.
I thought maybe he died or something. I was like, oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, like, no.
I thought you meant like the Captain Archer guy died. I was like, I was going to be a little slightly annoyed, but no, that's, you made a joke.
No. I'm not going to spoil it on you. I actually sat down with my 9-year-old and watched an episode of The Next Generation a few days ago. And I was surprised because she was into it. She dug it.
Sorry, I had a weird internet spike. I couldn't hear you there.
Oh, it's all good. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I actually sat down and saw an episode of Enterprise or Next Generation with my 9-year-old the other day, and she was actually into it.
I going back and rewatching those, it makes me realize the first season of The Next Generation really sucked.
Yeah, it wasn't that great.
It was not good at all. In fact,
they found their footing afterwards.
Yeah, and it was once Riker went with the beard, suddenly the show got good, and I don't know why that is, but that. Season 3 ending with Locutus of Borg is one of my favorite season finales of any TV show ever. I just think it was so masterfully done and well written. I love that.
Yeah, they were solid. And you put that handsome son of a bitch in a beard, and I mean, it just takes right off.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you make the leap from writing press releases and doing like office day-to-day stuff, because I mean, the way you were talking at first, it kind of sounded like a ship without a captain, and a little bit like you had Rob doing the, you know, the art and stuff and all this other stuff, but nobody really knew how to run an office. So,
well, that is for sure. None of us knew what the fuck we were doing. I mean, there is without a question that none of us had any real idea what the hell we were doing. So I completely acknowledge that. I think the industry was kind and sales were strong enough that we were able to screw up stuff like repeatedly and still stay in business. I mean, there's no way that a company today that made some of the series of mistakes that we made early on would weather like we did back then. You know, the industry is very unforgiving now. And yeah, so we were very fortunate, caught up in the times. But the way I was only on the marketing and business side for about 2 years. And what sort of happened is it was me, Eric Stevenson, Dan Fraga, Rob Liefeld, and Marat Michaels. That was sort of like the inner five of Extreme Studios. And Eric runs, he's the publisher at Image now, but we were the five, and Eric ran the Youngblood, like the Brigade, you know, he ran that side of the superhero stuff. But Rob wanted to do a Battlestar Galactica comic, and he knew I was a fan and that Eric wasn't. So that was sort of my first foray into editorial, was that I got to edit a line of books called Maximum Press, which became Evangeline. There was a book called Asylum, which was an anthology series. Battlestar Galactica. Then the first comic I ever wrote was part of that line, and it was called Lady Pendragon. And then I did another book called Six String Samurai with John Stensman as well. That was just a movie tie-in. And I did 18 issues of Lady Pendragon. I did another 10 issues of a book called Alley Cat. Worked on a few other things, including Dark Sector and a couple other things. And the thing was, I never really had love for the writing process or love for comics like so many people did. So in 99, I'd written 2 or 3 years worth of comics from 96 to 99, but I got married in 1999. And when I got married, and then my wife and I at the time, my first wife, when we had two kids back to back, I realized I needed to get a job. And Extreme Studios had folded by then. And that's the other point of that equation is Rob's Extreme closed in 96. There was another company called Awesome Comics that was the only time I've ever worked outside of Image was for Awesome Comics, which was Rob and Jeff Loeb, Ian Churchill. There were some good books there. Jeff Matsuda, Alan Moore wrote Supreme and Youngblood, and Steve Scrooge was the artist for Youngblood. There was some fun stuff we were doing. So I got to edit Alan Moore. That was fun.
That has to be intimidating.
Well, I think, you know, to be fair, you're not really editing him. You know, when I'm editing writers working with people today, I will often give them story notes and thoughts and ideas. And see, the thing is, if I was Alan's editor today, I might engage him in actual conversation, some thoughts and ideas. I tend to my editorial stance has always been one of, I want the writer to come up with the idea on their own, whether it's their idea or not. So usually what I do, my editorial style is I just ask a lot of questions. You know, and usually that works. It doesn't always work because sometimes people dig in. But I'll usually go to the writers and I'll say, hey, have you ever thought about this here? Or, that's pretty coincidental. Have you ever thought about this? You know, there's a difference between sort of plot editing and script editing. You know, script editing is a little more refined, more like copy editing. Sometimes you're just doing punctuation and stuff like that. Or I usually, when I'm editing dialogue, I usually look for a way to trim it. That's usually what writers get wrong is they do too much dialogue.
You got to cut the fat. Yeah. Because you're showing and telling, so.
Yeah. So, and yeah, then eventually, so I didn't write a single comic from, I think, 2000 to 2008. I don't think I wrote a single comic. And then in 2008, I got divorced from my first wife. And I was kind of depressed, and I thought maybe writing a new book would be therapeutic. So I wrote a book called Think Tank, and published it with Rasan Ekdahl through Top Cow, and I started working at Top Cow in 99, by the way, and was hired by Dave Wall and Mark Silvestri to go in, basically take over the business side of Top Cow as well. But when I got over there, they both had told me that they liked my Lady Pendragon book and were interested in me writing books. I told them initially I was not because I had back-to-back children, et cetera, and that stuff is taxing. But like I said, after I got divorced, I had a little extra free time and I started writing again. I wrote a book called Think Tank and I put it out. It did reasonably well, so I did another volume. And then I did about 600 other books since then. So, you know, I mean, it sort of, now I actually quite enjoy it, writing the process. I don't really like work for hire. I really don't enjoy, like, I would not really enjoy writing Spider-Man. I mean, I would probably do it just to say I did it, but it's not something, you know, everyone is such big fans of, like, my lifelong dream has been to write, you know, I don't know, The Fan, you know, whatever. So, you know, so everyone has some stupid story they want to tell from their childhood. I don't really have any of that when it comes to comic book characters, because it wasn't really part of my life at all. My sisters didn't read them, you know, and they weren't even in, I lived on military bases, and so they were not very prevalent.
So, yeah, being a guy that wasn't really into comics, it seems like were you a sci-fi kid?
Yes, I was a extreme, you know, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Robert Heinlein, you know, all those great science fiction writers, Michael Crichton. I loved all those. All the 50s, 60s, and 70s science fiction were just fantastic. And I read a lot of that voraciously. And that's one thing I'm really happy about in my comic book life, is I've met a lot of my childhood author fans.
Oh, cool.
I'd never met Arthur C. Clarke, but I did meet Heinlein before he died. And I met, God, what's his name? The guy that wrote City on the Edge of Forever.
Fuck. Oh,
Harlan Ellison. I met and hung out with him.
How was he?
He was really good. We share a lawyer, and I think he realized I was genuine, because I wasn't just another sycophantic fan, because we had a lot of interesting conversations at this convention. And then he was talking to me about something, and I don't remember what it was, because he was really fascinated by the fact that I had a master's degree in physics and I was in comics, and he thought that was just funny. So he wanted to get to know me better. And I remember, it's a crazy story. I've told this a few times, but so I was coming back from, I think it was Chicago, Rosemont, the Wizard World Chicago show, like in the 90s or early 2000s. And so, you know, I'm back in coach, and Harlan was in first class. I remember walking by him as I went to my coach seat. And then suddenly I see Harlan standing in the aisleway, talking to this middle-aged woman next to me, asking if she'd be willing to switch seats with him in first class. And she's like, sure. So she went up and sat in first class. He sat next to me in coach to talk to me. And so we talked from all the way from Chicago back to Los Angeles. And I quite enjoyed that. It was one of the more interesting times of my life. And I think a lot of these older science fiction writers wanted to be scientists, or like Arthur C. Clarke and some of these people were engineers. I mean, they were legitimate scientists who also just happened to be writers. And so I think they saw me as a kindred spirit, because I could at least talk to them about the shit they were talking about. And, you know, I wrote my master's thesis on, you know, quantum entanglement, dark matter, and what a third dimensional being would look like to a sixth dimensional being. And so just having those conversations with those people about those things was quite fascinating, because the concept of a sixth dimensional being didn't really exist when they were in school. So good times.
That's awesome. And yeah, Harlan Ellison seems like he would scare the hell out of me in person, just because he seemed intense every time I've seen him.
You know, the thing is, I didn't have a perception. And I think maybe that helped, because I saw him and I said, and we were talking about something, and he asked me, I can't remember what he asked me. He asked me my opinion about something Star Trek related. And I don't think he even knew that I didn't know that he wrote an episode. And I there was an episode that I talked about. I can't even remember what it was now, but I kind of trashed it. I said, oh, that's one of the hokier ones. And he just started laughing. And he's like, oh, this Fred Thalberg or Fred something was the guy that had written the episode. And he started telling me the story about this guy. And I didn't know who he was, but it was a funny story. And I don't remember the story either, but I liked him. He's a nice enough guy. You know, I've met some salty motherfuckers in my day. You know, I mean, there's a few writers that I've come across or older creatives, and I get it. They're angry because maybe they didn't get treated as well as they could have. But man, I hate it when they take that anger out on the fans.
Oh yeah, you know? Yeah.
I do not like that at all.
Luckily, I haven't ran into any of those, but I've run into creators that are old enough now in the game where they just don't give a shit, so they'll just say whatever. We have some genuine discussions, like while we're editing this, like, should we leave this in? He's going pretty hard on so and so. Maybe we should cut this out. that's always fun because it's like, tell us what you really think, man.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, the thing is, I think once you're retired, you really kind of don't give a shit anymore. You know, I'm not retired. I still have to work in this industry.
Oh, yeah. So I'm not going to get you guys, in any.
Yeah, you're not going to get me in trouble because I'm not going to say anything. And I'm usually pretty careful about what I say, too.
You're like, Indy, darling, Colleen Duran, if you only knew how she really acted.
Colleen is great. I love her.
So can we talk about the clock a little bit?
Yeah, of course.
So
go ahead.
Oh, well, where did the idea come from? And how did you come about working with Colleen? Because, man, she's amazing.
Well, little known thing that I've only talked about a couple times, but Colleen and I dated very briefly back in 1993. Like, I think we went on like 2 dates. And she lived on the East Coast in Virginia, wherever the hell she lives, and I lived on the West Coast. So it wasn't like we were going to have this, you know, long love affair. It was just more of a hangout kind of thing at a couple cons. But we became friends after that, and it was chill. And I've known her ever since. I've been talking to her for about 10 years now about working on a project together. And about 5 years ago, she told me she had an opening in her schedule and was interested in working with me and asked what book I'd be interested in doing. So I pitched her the basic idea of The Clock, which, you know, it's a eugenics conspiracy thriller about the weaponization of cancer. And this was, and she, her eyes kind of lit up. She's like, oh, people don't ask me to do stuff like that. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, was that the kind of book you'd like to do? She's like, yeah, I would love to do that. I'm like, okay, let's do that. So I wrote the first issue about 5 years ago. And then she had a series of health issues that knocked her out of the industry for like a year and a half. And then when she got back, she called me and there was some Warren Ellis job and then some Neil Gaiman job that she was offered. She's like, please let me do these. I'm sorry. And so I wasn't going to say no because I knew that would just help me sell more books. The fact that she put out Trollbridge with Neil and then she did that project, whatever it was, with Warren. I never actually read that one. But so, and then about a year ago, she's like, look, I know I've taken 4 years to draw the first issue, but I'm done with it. Can we just finish this out? So I wrote the second and third issues and then the first 2 issues came out. And then the third issue was one of the first victims of the non-publishing of COVID because of COVID-19 crap. So, you know, I put out issue one, issue two. It was really interesting because it was about a global pandemic that was killing people all over the world. How are people reacting to it, et cetera, et cetera, and so forth. Unfortunately, because issue two came out in February, issue three was supposed to come out towards the end of March, and it has not yet come out. That issue's been done since late February. But I think now, given the delays, because I think the earliest we'd be able to put it out would be June or July. And then she and I sort of slowed our roll on the fourth issue, so she's not even done with the fourth issue yet. But I think we're going to release it just as a trade. Because it was a 4-issue miniseries. That's all it was. And you'll see by the end of it why it's not an ongoing story. It doesn't have the happiest of happy endings. it has an okay ending. But, you know, I love that movie, Contagion. I think I'd just seen the movie Contagion. And I remember asking myself the question, I wonder if cancer could be viral. And I remember asking that question to myself. I started doing some research. And then I started looking into how cancer works, and I went to this biotech conference I weaseled my way into and went and sat in a panel with like 5 of the leading immunotherapists in the nation. And they were all talking about, you know, cancer treatments, et cetera, and how, and this was 5-6 years ago that this happened. And they were talking then about how, you know, chemotherapy doesn't work. It's horrible. We need better ways to do things. And we're still chemotherapy people today. But so at the end of that panel, they took a Q&A and no one was asking questions. So I had that thought about the weaponization. So I asked it. I said, do you know if anyone has ever tried to weaponize cancer? And I realized after that I wasn't at a comic book convention, that I was actually at a medical biotechnology convention. Because as I looked around at the silent 50 people all staring at me, you know, and the people up at the panel kind of looking at me with their jaw open, like, did he just ask what we thought he asked? Because that's just where my mind goes, you know? And so he's like, we're not going to answer that, but thank you for coming. He ended the panel. So I found that guy on the floor like a couple hours later, and I explained to him that I was a science fiction comic writer, and he started laughing. He's like, oh, okay. I'm glad. We're glad you're not a terrorist.
Yeah, yeah. are you from the military? Like, what are your plans?
Right. So that's kind of where the idea for The Clock came. And then that guy that I met, I still he's friends with me on Facebook now, and we chat about a lot of stuff. And you know, the core idea of the clock. Well, I don't want to give too much of it away since it's not out yet.
Yeah. We'll put that on the back burner. And man, I can't wait to read it because it looks fascinating. And Colleen Duran is amazing. I love her artwork.
The thing that's amazing about her artwork is the range of facial expressions she has. And I think that is where I've been so fortunate, because artists like the Sedgwicks, both Linda and Stepan, and you know, Colleen Doran, and some of these other artists I've had the privilege of working with, are all amazing storytellers. And see, that is the one big advantage I feel like I have in the industry over a lot of other creators and independent writers, is because I'm on the business side, and because, you know, I'm the president of Top Cow, I can pretty much work with whatever artist I want to, you know, and that makes my job so much easier, because, you know, because I'll talk to the artists ahead of time and I'll say, well, how do you want me to write these things? Do you want it full script? Do you want it more plot style? And then we'll talk about the stories and the ideas for the stories. And I am incredibly collaborative with my artists, and I always share ownership with my artists 50-50, even if it's my idea completely, because to me, they're the ones that are doing the lion's share of the work, you know. It might take me 5 years to write a story, but you know, most of that is just thinking about it. But the actual process of sitting down and writing the story takes me maybe a week at most. And most of these artists are living with these things for months and months in and months out, dealing with it on a daily basis. So, you know, I can write 5 comics in a month if I really tried. I don't think there's any artist, even Jack Kirby, that could do 5 books in a month.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a Sisyphean task to produce one comic, you know, as it is. So it's, I can't imagine doing multiple.
The luck I had as a writer also was the fact that I was editing Alan Moore and Warren Ellis and Garth Ennis and some amazing fucking writers in the early days of Image and Top Cow that I had the privilege of working with, and awesome. And I really was able to sort of talk to them and study their scripts and their formats and get kind of inside their heads. And that period of time, especially Awesome Comics, I feel like made me a good editor. You know, I feel like I am a good editor now. I don't really enjoy copy editing at all. You know, I prefer to hire someone else to do that annoying little period and comma bullshit. But in terms of, you know, making sure the characters have their proper story arc, et cetera, you know, and everything lines up tonally, I'm really good at that.
What's the biggest thing you've learned as an editor?
Oh my gosh, working with talent. I think I mentioned it earlier. It's because as an editor, I really see my job as kind of being a coach, because it's not just this is where I think sometimes the big two, Marvel and DC, they don't see themselves this way unless they're the good ones like Bob Harris. Most of them just see it as a job where they're trafficking stuff in and out, telling people what to do. They're hiring and firing people. I always look, when I'm editing a book, even if I'm not writing it, I'll look at it as this is my sports team. You know, and I've got to keep all these guys motivated. I got to stay on top of them. And I really don't like the editors that tend to try to make a heavy stamp on everything they get involved in, because then it becomes about the editor and not about the creators. To me, comics is really about the creators and letting these people kind of flourish. And I think giving them the environment and the tools and the freedom to be able to do that is very fulfilling, especially when they do a good job.
I bet. So, look, can I turn that question around a little bit? What's the biggest thing you've learned from your editing work that has helped your writing?
I have to tell you, I think that every editor should try to write comics, because I think the process of writing itself made me a much better editor. Because when you stare at a blank sheet of paper or a blank screen and you really don't know what to put there, you have a better understanding of what's involved in the process. But, you know, I got to tell you, the thing I learned about editing that made me a better writer was to stop worrying so much about what I was writing, because I knew there were going to be multiple drafts. So one thing I always tell young writers is, don't worry about writer's block. Don't worry if you can't figure everything out. Just write it very quickly. And if you have certain scenes but you don't know how to connect them, just write it in there. Write bridge connection later, you know, and leave a blank page so you remember to do it. And just keep going, because a lot of times once you get to the scenes that you already had in mind, then you realize, oh, this is how I should connect that. I need to drop this, you know, he needs to get this key so he can get in the storage locker, so he can get this gun, so he can get this. You know, you have these procedural things that need to make sense and all line up. And those sometimes drive the story and the narrative. And so, you know, to me, rewriting and writing quickly, I think, are good. And less is more. I think brevity, you know, every new writer tends to use a lot of words. And if you go back and look at my work from the 90s and compare it to my work today, I probably use half as many words as I did when I started. And I go back and I reread some of that flowery crap that I wrote when I was in my 20s. And it makes me nauseous a little bit because I'm like, oh, my God. If I read some of that stuff as a sample, I wouldn't hire them.
Really?
And that was me.
I noticed the other day on Twitter, you were talking about writing yourself into a corner and you know, not to get too worked up about it. You just have to kind of throw it out and get over it. And
yeah,
that was kind of eye-opening for me, just seeing somebody who is, you know, somebody, you're a pro and you're still going through that stuff.
Yeah, it's part of the process. Everyone goes through it. The question is what do you do about it? You know, do you have people you can talk to? You know, I have people I can call that I can say, hey, here's the story I'm doing. Here's what I did. And then a guy like Brian Hill or a guy like Rob Levin or even a guy like Mark Silvestri will tell me, hey, what about this? And I'm like, fucking, that's it. You know, and sometimes it's just having that conversation. One thing I do a lot, I do this a lot, is before I sit down and write a story, I will pitch it to every one of my friends and I will pitch it to them in detail. This is the story. These are the main characters. Because a lot of time as I'm having that conversation with other people, the ideas flow with me while I'm speaking, or the conversation back and forth with these trusted people that I care about spurns ideas that help me. And so, you know, everyone does different things. Like I listen to different music for different books to kind of switch my moods, you know, and the fact that there's a whole category of people that see me now as a romance writer kind of is bizarre, because I've always seen myself as a science fiction writer. But when, you know, Cedric started doing Sunstone and it did so well, you know, we created this alternate category of books, which included Sun's Swing and Sugar. And these are slice of life romance books.
You read some sexy comics, man.
I wrote them, you know, and that's, it's just so weird to me that I wrote romance. And it's hard, man. I got to tell you, I never read romance as a kid. I was never into rom-coms. I was kind of a Boy Scout kid, you know, and outdoors, played a lot of sports. But
did you have to take yourself to romance school for to prepare for that?
I the subjects had to school me, because there's a shorthand to science fiction that you use all the time that people use. Like, you don't you can get away with just introducing a scientist in the middle of his career in a science fiction story. You can't really do that in a love story, you know, in the terms of the relationship, what the plot is about. You know, like the floating Star Wars words at the beginning of those movies works. And that's why so many people have introductions that are prose and comics and various things, like a 2 or 3 paragraph thing that brings you into the world, you know. But writing romance is really fucking difficult. And because you have to show people why they care, you know, you can't just tell them why they care. You have to show them and give them the time to fall in love with these characters, so that then when you twist up the characters' relationships and lives, it makes the reader feel invested in it. And the readership is different too, because it's women. You know, the people who read Swing and Sugar and Sunstone are primarily middle-aged women, you know, and the group who reads my science fiction is almost entirely middle-aged guys.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool that you're able to play to both, you know, both of those audiences. And I'm sure it doesn't hurt at all that the Sedgwicks draw some really attractive people.
It doesn't hurt at all. No. And I definitely, and see, the thing is, there's a formula to the way they do their books, these slice of life romances. And it took me a while to figure it out. But now that I kind of understand how they do it, I can sort of replicate it. And I've been able to replicate it. Everything is that, you know, I don't want to say writing is formulaic, but writing is pretty formulaic. You know, I mean, if you follow sort of the 3-act structures and, you know, you look at all that sort of stuff, there's a specific way to do these things that keeps it compelling, and you just have to crack the formula.
Is it hard for you to enjoy stuff knowing how formulaic stuff can be, like when you're just in your own time, like when you watch a movie or whatever? Yeah.
It drives me fucking nuts. I hate it because no. And I got to tell you, here's the thing I've learned. Okay. Coincidences, I hate them. And they happen so often in film and television where something is a coincidental thing. Because to me, a coincidence is a lazy storytelling. You know, if you're using a coincidence as a means of driving the plot, meaning like these two characters happen to get stuck in the same cab together, that is a coincidence, but that is a plot vehicle to move the plot forward, that why that is. You know, another one is that this car, you know, I mean, there's so many are so broad, but it really comes down to making people like the characters. And this is why, as a writer and an editor, there are so many films that have plot holes so big you could drive giant trucks through them. But a lot of people don't care because they like those characters. They enjoyed the storyline. It was slick. It was sexy. It was fun. You know, I mean, there's a million movies like that that make no sense whatsoever. They really, really do not. And which is why I think when there are films that are really fucking good, like the first Highlander film, where the story is just so ironclad and it works so well, and you like the characters and it creates this great mythology, you know, I think that's a beautiful thing when it happens, you know, and it happens very rarely, you know, because for every story like that there is, there's thousands of other stories that come and go that no one thinks about twice.
Yeah. And I'm with you on the Highlander movies, or the first film especially, because it was pretty amazing. I was actually, there's a list thing on Twitter now, which I'm probably not going to do. Somebody tagged me in it, and I hate when they do that, but it was like your five perfect films. Would that be up there on your list?
Yeah, I think so. I think Highlander 1 is a beautiful film, and I love the transitions. That they work so well. And that character, that actor that plays that character, is in a lot of really shitty, goofy films. But he was good. Christopher Lambert, I think his name is. But
yes,
he was really good in that movie, and I love the guy that played the Kurgan. The fuck's that actor's name? He was also in Shawshank as one of the guards.
Oh, man. Yeah.
What's his name? I don't remember his name. Clayton or something. It doesn't matter. But it is interesting to me that if you look sometimes at scripts and how plain they are, and these actors brought it to life, you know?
You and know, that like, theme song slapped.
Yeah.
When I also kind of want to talk about like why you did the physics degree. What happened with that? Was that just something you got into comics and you're like, okay, this is what I want to do?
Kind of. I mean, I didn't finish my degree until early 95. So I was still working on it for the first 2 years while I was working at Extreme. But you know, in the first 2 years of Extreme Studios, I was traveled to like 10 different countries. You know, I did like 30 different conventions. I met all these amazing people. I was pretty smitten by entertainment at that point because there was less division actually than there is now. Like if you were a comic book person, it wasn't uncommon for you to, you know, hobnob with film and TV people, but now it's less so. It's interesting. It's changed quite a bit, but
that's wild. Also, you have some, speaking of film and television, you have some background in that as well.
I wrote for 2 seasons of the Power Rangers.
How was that?
In 2000. It was fun. I did that because my buddy Greg Aronowitz was the showrunner. And he and I had worked together at Extreme together. He was the guy that built the Bad Rock costume, the Kodiak costume, and the Youngblood Battlecruiser. These life-size things we took to conventions. And I became friends with him, and then he got hired to be the showrunner for the show. He always wanted to be a director, and he asked me if I'd be interested in writing an episode. So I did a freelance episode for Space Patrol Delta, and then they liked it. I think it was Disney at the time who owned it. I'm not sure who owns it now. And they hired, and I wrote like 18 episodes over the next 2 years. So it was good money. It was weird because they would send you the Japanese footage of the people fighting the monsters and then the costumes. That was all pickup from a Japanese TV show.
Yeah.
And they would send, right. And you would just write the parts that connected the American cast. And sometimes the episode lined up really well. There was a couple of those I wrote in less than an hour, literally, because when I got the Japanese episode, it just translated so well. I just used it, you know, and I changed some stuff and made it a little more understandable to an American audience. But about there was 2 or 3 that were like that. The most of them I had to actually go in and actually write. And it was kind of fun because it was a little bit of a jigsaw puzzle. So because they would give you like the, you know, it's usually, what was it, 28 minutes or 24 minutes? I can't remember. It's been so long.
I think it's like 24 minutes. Yeah, because you have to allow for commercials and stuff.
24 minutes, but they would give you like 15 or 16 minutes of Japanese footage to use. So you were only shooting like 7 or 8 minutes of footage, and then they would do voiceover tracks for when they were in costumes to, instead of using the Japanese actor track. You know, Space Patrol Delta was fun because the Yellow Ranger in Space Patrol Delta was this Latina woman who was hot. She's big. She had a big bosom. Okay, and there's a point to the reason why, because the Japanese in the Japanese version, it was a short guy who looked like a 15-year-old boy. So there was this, and she was taller than him. So when you would see this actress morph into the Yellow Power Rangers, I would always laugh. And I would say, oh, yeah, go Power Rangers, and the boobs fell off, you know? It's just kind of silly.
It's science fiction, man. Anything can happen. So yeah. Has there been any more traction on the Postal television project?
No. Oh, that died a grisly death at Hulu, and is a sad story for me personally, because as a comic book writer and you get these scripts from film or TV writers, most often they're a huge disappointment, meaning you get these things and you read it and you're like, I don't even like this, and it's based on the thing I wrote. That has happened to me the vast majority of times I've seen scripts adapted from my work. This was one of those times where I actually read the script. The kid Seth Meyers wrote it. Seth Hoffman. And I read this thing and I put it down, and then I read it again. And then I called my agent. I said, Rick, I really like this a lot. It's really good.
He got it.
And like,
he got it.
Yeah, he got it, and he did a good job with it. And then because of Handmaid's Tale, Hulu killed it, which is interesting because I think the woman who ran it at the time made that decision was fired the next year. But my show had already been put into turnaround. So, I mean, we've trying to sell it again. You know, the shitty part is like, I saw this Amazon show, I think it was Amazon, called Briar Patch Lane, which has already been canceled, but it came out last year and it was the same fucking story idea. So, you know, and the thing is, I look at when that book was published back in, you know, 8-9 years ago, this thing, I looked up to curious to see where this other show came from. And it's something that was pitched by these two guys last year. I'm not saying they ripped it off. You can't really prove that. It's very hard to prove, but you never know. You never know. I mean, that happens pretty commonly, where I'll see people in film and TV with comics on their desks reading them, and then suddenly they come out with some TV show that's very similar. You know, it is very curious.
Yeah, yeah. And especially now that people are kind of tipped off to the fact that comic companies are basically IP farms for some, yep, for some groups. I never in my wildest dreams as a kid in the, you know, the 80s and 90s did I think that I would ever see good movies with these characters that I know and love in them. And now it's just, you know, people are kind of coming around to it, and I worry that it's going to take some of the joy out of seeing it when that's all there is. Does that make sense? Where, like,
yeah,
maybe it's not as special anymore because there's so many comic superheroes, specifically superhero things.
But I don't really write superheroes, and I don't really like superheroes. I mean, that's the other thing about me is, like, I personally look at superheroes as being kind of silly, you know?
Yeah, I mean, well, you're the guy that wrote a book about contagious cancer, so.
Yeah.
Which would be a banger of a show.
Well, probably not now, you know, because given everything going on with the world, I'm curious to see, because that third issue cover that Colleen had done, that she gave me the original art from, was that granite angel over a tombstone that said R.I.P. the human race. She drew that sent that to me about a month before the world shut down from coronavirus.
It might be a good idea. That's not the first thing that comes out.
Yeah.
So how have things been at Top Cow now that coronavirus has just completely put the brakes on so many projects?
Well, it hasn't. I think it has affected us less than some of the bigger companies, because we already did things like crowdfunding. We did a lot of digital initiatives with Humble Bundle and different groups, and we have heavily pushed our direct sales store for a decade now. and have really bolstered that over the past 10 years, especially because of the volume of conventions that I do. Now, not being able to do, like I've had, I do at least one, sometimes two shows a month. The last show I did was Richmond, Virginia, and that was at the end of January. And I have had, I think, 12 shows canceled. No surprise. I mean, including San Diego Comic-Con. Yeah. I'm starting to wonder if New York Comic-Con is going to happen in October. It might not. You know, I mean, we shall see. I mean, right now, Javits Center and San Diego Convention Center are full of sick homeless people.
Yeah, yeah. Man, if people stay the hell indoors, it might have a shadow of a chance coming back. And I hope it does, because there are a lot of people counting. These conventions aren't just like a good way for the fans to meet the creators and see new stuff. It really helps out the smaller studios and independent artists and writers. So yeah, I really hope it gets, in a safe manner, gets back to where it needs to be.
Right. No, I agree. And I think that, but the thing is that the convention sales, I mean, I look at that and, you know, all these conventions I would have done, I'm just looking at, okay, that's $50,000 out of my bottom line this year that I was counting on. So that is not helpful. But, you know, like I said, we just finished the 25th anniversary Witchblade hardcover Kickstarter. I had just done the postal Kickstarter for the hardcover. And we have three other ones planned over the next 6 months that we've already gotten pretty far along. On top of that, I ran that Humble Bundle, which did a little over 100,000. And, you know, we move a significant amount of product through our own channels, meaning we do direct mail to fans. And I have a lot of people that come and buy from me for the shows. I mean, I've been doing so many shows over the last 12 years that I have people that they come to a show basically to catch up on whatever books I've done for that year. So, you know, it's all marketing, really. You know, I can tell you how many people make books that no one reads.
That's awesome that you're able to get out there. And there's a certain type of person that you see at the shows who are just killing at the booths. Yep. And it's like, oh, this guy knows how to talk to people.
Yep, that's what it is. It's all about keeping your head up, standing up, engaging people, talking to them. You know, there's a lot of little tricks, and I've learned from a lot of different people, and I've analyzed it. But it comes down to two things. One, people want to talk to you, and so if you're not approachable or interesting, you know, I mean, and I hate hard salesmen, especially in an entertainment forum. So I never do hard sales. Like I give out a lot of free first issues to get people to try my books. And, you know, I typically ask people what kind of books they like. You know, that's my number one question, because especially comic book conventions now, 2 out of 3 of the people that are going to walk by your booth at most shows, they don't read comics anyway. They're either into cosplay, they're into whatever, toys, you know, they came to get William Shatner's autograph. You know, I mean, there's a million reasons why people are there and they may not read comics, even if it's called a comic book convention. So the first thing I do is I ask people if they read comics. And like I said, 2 out of 3 people say no. And I'm like, oh, I should give it a try sometime. And they're like, oh, maybe someday. And I'm like, and that to me is sort of the end of the conversation, because if they don't read comics at all, then the chance that I'm going to convince them to is very slim. So I don't even waste my time. But if they say, yeah, no, yeah, I do read comics. Oh, what kind of comics do you like? And then depending on what they say, their answer to that question tells me whether or not I could sell them, and tells me whether or not which books I could sell to them. You know, so if someone's like mainly a Marvel or DC fan, you know, I might be able to sell them Cyberforce or Aphrodite 9. You know, someone that is maybe into Dark Horse or Image or Saga, there are other books I could sell. And so, and I say, oh, maybe you should take a look at this. And I usually have, like, for all my projects, I have 10, 20, 30 second little pitches that I use. And, you know, and usually I'm a fairly talkative guy, and I like to talk about interesting subjects. So if someone wants to hang out and chat with me for an hour or two, especially when it's slow, I will usually do that, mainly because it keeps me engaged. It keeps me doing something other than staring at the floor. And nothing attracts someone to come listen to you or hear you or look at you than someone else being there, you know. And one of the little tricks I learned early on is I usually always bring at least one person with me to the con, whether it's some girl I'm dating or one of the people that works with me. And I will ask them to stand on the other side of the table at times, you know, if it's a little slow or if it's first thing in the morning, because if someone is there looking already, it breaches that question in your mind of whether it's worth looking at or not, because someone else is, therefore it is. And so there's a lot of little psychological tricks you can use to try to get people to take a look at your stuff, and I try to use them all.
That's awesome. That is some valuable information, man. So what do you have planned next? Because you have the clock, and that's going to be eventually released as an OGN, I guess. And so what's next for Matt Hawkins?
Well, after that comes Swing Volume 3, which is being worked on by Yishun Li now from Beijing, actually. I've gotten the inside look of Chinese COVID from her. And I'm also working on a book with my think tank collaborator, Rasan Ekdahl, called The Rook, which is a buddy cop drama and told in Washington, D.C., which I can't think of a TV show about cops that was told in Washington, D.C. And it's one of the more fascinating areas for police because of the conflicts and diplomatic immunities and the diplomats. And so I wanted to do that. So we're developing that, and we've been developing it for a while. And the idea is he's a rookie, but he's also a chess master. So, and that's why they call him the Rook.
For a second, I thought you were talking, there was an old comic from Warren, I think, back in the day called The Rook. And this is Time Traveler, and it was the 70s, but it was weird.
People let their trademarks lapse, and that's, there's a website, it's uspto.gov. It is the patent and trademark website. And if you go on there, you can do a trademark search under Class 16, which is comic book and comic book publishing, and you can see if a name is available. I tell people to do this all the time, because the thing is, if you go to a trademark attorney and ask them to run a search for you to see if, you know, the name Youngblood is available, they'll do it and they'll charge you like $250 for going into a website
and
Youngblood. And that's essentially what you can do for free, because it's the website offers it for free, but they'll charge you for that. And so once I realized that's what they're doing, you know, you can go in there and you'll see if it's dead, Class 16 dead, and it's been dead for 15 years, then you know they're not going to challenge it, you know, and then you can snag the name.
Have you ever gotten your heart broken by that process before? Just like you were set on a name?
Yes, many times. Well,
what was that? Or do you have a good example?
I don't remember. There was once, Inferno. You know, we had a book called Inferno. We ended up calling it Inferno : Hellbound. I think a lot of times when you see a title of a book and it has a colon and then a subtitle, that's usually to get around trademarking. So, if we wanted to call, a book The Magdalena, you know, if we hadn't already published a book called The Magdalena, and we didn't own that name, and then I looked online and saw that there was a Magdalena comic, but I was determined to call it The Magdalena, I could call my comic The Order of the Magdalena and make the Magdalena part huge and make the Order of the being a little teeny line above it. And you could still publish a book called Magdalena.
That's cool. That's cool.
There's ways around everything.
And these are all, like, I'm sure, things that you've learned just from being in the office.
Yes. Well, just, you know, and trying to be creative and figure out ways to do things and get things done that you want to get done. You know, it's not always easy.
Oh, yeah. So, man, we're right at an hour, and I don't want to take too much more of your time up. Do you have anything else you want to talk about before we shut her down?
Well, I think that Top Cow does an annual talent hunt, and we just wrapped it, and we're just in the process of picking the winners for the art and the writer. So I know there are a lot of people that want to break into comics, and I think the Top Cow talent hunt is one of the few legitimate ways to do it, because we've introduced people like Teeny Howard and Isaac Goodhart and Steve Fox, all people who are actively involved in Marvel and DC, who were hired initially out of our talent hunt. So I would encourage people to follow our feeds and pay attention to the talent hunt and participate, because it's done good for a lot of people.
So on that, I help run a group called The Comic Jam, and we're just a collection of artists and writers, and we make one page comics each week. But we had a bunch of people from that group to enter in that contest, and you guys really go out of your way to make it as easy as possible for people wanting to, you know, try their hand at it. And it's so commendable how you guys go about it. So as an aspiring comic creator and as somebody who loves comics, thank you for all that you do in that regard. That is so amazing how much you guys, it seems like you're really trying to not only to give back to the fans and everything, but to also really find the next talent. So that's awesome.
Mark has always done that for artists, and we've always had one form or another of some sort of an artist search because we're always looking for artists. And I added the writer thing in a few years ago because I realized that it's actually much easier to become a comic book artist than it is to become a comic book writer because there's more of them. But the other thing with comic book writers is you're competing with the same 200 to 250 to 300 people, and that's really all there is. You know, I'm still competing with Mark Waid, Kurt Busiek, Warren Ellis, you know, all these famous authors that are still working in the business. And these people work for decades and decades doing this work. So it is very hard to get in as a comic book writer. It's almost impossible, you know. So we decided to add to our annual talent hunt for artists because a writing component. And that's been the biggest pain in the ass. The thing is, I can look at someone's art and know within about 5 seconds whether they have any shot at all of working with us. And honestly, that's about 1 in 1,000 portfolios I look at. Then I'm like, oh, this guy's good. You know, I met a guy in Virginia that I hired and I'm working on a project with him. The last time that happened was probably a decade ago.
Oh, wow.
So it's not very often. The problem with reading a writer is you actually have to read it, you know, yeah. And reading scripts is not fun because most of them suck. You know, I mean, no offense to the people that are doing the talent hunt, but about 70-75% of them just aren't very good. You know, and so sometimes it's a bit of a struggle to get through those. And I always tell people, I said, you know, the one thing as a gatekeeper, someone who hires people, you need to be concise and less is more, because I think the one thing people mistakenly do when they're pitching is they try to have everything written out and fleshed out. So they're sending this massive document. And the problem with that is people on my end of this, we don't enjoy reading this stuff ever. Very rarely do you enjoy reading it. It feels like work. So we're looking constantly for a reason to stop reading it, you know? So don't give us one, you know? I mean, that's what I always tell people. Don't give me a reason to stop reading. You know, you giving me a reason to stop reading could be as simple as, you know, you're sending out a submission broad and you write to me and say at Dark Horse Comics, you know, I mean, I'm like, I can't even figure out which company I work for. Then why should I bother reading his thing? You know, and I know that might seem petty, but the problem is when you're staring at 800 scripts, you really are looking for a reason not to read them. And sometimes you start getting through and the punctuation is really bad, or the characters aren't introduced properly, or the story itself makes no sense. The thing is, I will never stop before about page 5 or 6, but there's a lot of these things I read that I don't get past that because I'm reading to that point and I'm like, it's already lost me. So, yeah. And the thing with writing talent hunts and breaking in is it needs to be a simple story with a single sort of twist, and it should only deal with 1 or 2 characters because you're talking about a single 20-page story, and everyone tries to throw everything in. They try to tell this massive story, and the other thing people do wrong all the time is we tell very clearly it's a self-contained one-shot storyline. People submit these things all the time, and they have it leave on this massive cliffhanger, or they write, here's where the next 80 issues would be. And whenever I see that, I skim through the stuff before I even start reading it. But if they can't follow the fucking directions, I'm not going to read it. And that's the other thing that drives me nuts, by the way, as an editor and as someone who hires some people, these things. I can't tell you how often I get people who ping me online asking me questions that are very, very clearly answered in the rules. You know what I mean? And that annoys me. But it is what it is.
That I was actually going to ask, you know, hey man, how are some ways to help your submit? But man, you just answered all that.
Well, I think the best thing you can do with submissions is it depends on also what you're doing. Are you writing a Spider-Man story, or are you writing an original idea about a firefighter who gets telepathy? You know, I just wing that. I mean, you know, there's because those are completely different stories. The nice thing about writing a Spider-Man story is you don't have to explain anything. People know the origin. People know what his powers are. You know, you can just tell sort of a regular story without having to worry about introducing the world, introducing who J. Jonah Jameson is, you know, all these sort of things and these things. Like, if you're writing an original story, not only do you have to introduce the characters and the storyline to make the character interesting and compelling, but you also need to introduce everything else in the entire world, the story, the rules, the laws of the universe and how it works. And if there are crazy powers, you know, you need to understand what they are and why they work, or have a reasonable idea of why they work. And you have to do all this in 20 pages. It's not easy. I actually think writing comics is significantly harder than writing novels, screenplays. I think it's much more difficult.
Do you ever have any desire to branch out into novels or anything like that? Because that was kind of your bread and butter as a kid.
Yes. In fact, I am trying my hand at my first novel right now. So
really?
That is something. And part of that is just a looking at the numbers. I mean, I think the best-selling comic book last year in the United States sold like 300,000 copies. The best-selling prose book in the United States last year sold like 28 million copies. So there's a significantly larger paid reading audience for novels than there is for comic books. So I am trying to make that transition. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. My sister writes novels.
Oh, cool. So, man, you have a very intellectually, like a very intellectual family, from what I understand.
Yeah, I'm the dumb one.
Oh God, don't say that.
I'm serious. I was the one that wasted his education.
Well, I mean, you made something, you know, that is completely and totally your own thing, which is, you know, people don't daydream about really being a surgeon or a physicist or whatever. They daydream about making it big in comics one day and stuff like that. And that's something that you've accomplished. And that is cool as hell to me. When you're working on that book, is it going to be in the sci-fi vein?
Which book?
The novel.
The novel is Think Tank. I'm writing a Think Tank book set in the present, but when he's 14. So the continuity does not match the graphic novel continuity at all. It is based on a 14-year-old kid right now who is approached for the first time by the military, and he's in high school. And my sister, Carrie, skipped two grades, and I almost skipped a grade, but I didn't do so because I was too immature. I remember the woman that was giving me the test told me that I passed the intellectual part, but I wasn't mature enough because I crawled up on the desk in the middle of the test and sat cross-legged while I was talking to her, which to me was like, really? That shows immaturity?
But that's whatever. A baller move right there. That's... Yeah. That is Isaac Hayes in the middle of a recording contract discussion, pulling out a 45 and setting it on the desk. That is the
equivalent.
Well, Matt Hawkins, dude, thank you so much for talking to us today. And next time you have something coming up, by all means, hit us up. I'd love to talk to you again because I really had a blast talking to you.
Oh, sounds good, man. Anytime. And if there's some of my work you see that you want to talk about, just ping me and happy to do it anytime.
Thank you very much, man.
Sounds good. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you very much.
Have a great night. Be safe.
Same to you. Wash your hands, man.
I will. I'll do it right now.
All right.
Bye. Bye. Take care.
Don't hold me to it.
Welcome back. That was fun. Casey did
a great
job.
That was a lot of fun. I love Casey's demeanor during interviews. He's always makes it entertaining. And he just has that slow.
I just love that. I just love his NPR. All right. Welcome back to Spoiler Country. I'm Casey T. Allen. And today on the show, we're talking with Matt Hawkins. Hi, Matt. How you doing today, buddy?
Yeah. How do we get Matt back on?
I think we just email and ask him and do it. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's a matter of just making time and doing it.
All right, because he was a lot of fun, and I want to know more. I want to learn more. I want to know, you know, what got him where he was at and how he got there, because, man, the guy is a walking encyclopedia. So
I mean, I think we should play into his Twitter bio there and ask him to come on and DM a D&D game for us.
Yeah, we should. Could you imagine that?
That'd be pretty fun. Dude,
that would be a
speaking
lot
of D&D,
fun.
I just watched the D&D episode of Community last night.
Oh man, so good.
They got Fat Neil and they're trying to make it, you know, he's all happy and Pierce is being a dick because Pierce is a dick about Fat Neil, and they're going there. That was good. That made me want to play D&D. I was like, oh, this looks like so much fun.
Yeah. They do such that Yeah. Every time you bring up Community, we end up going to a diatribe. We got to do a show just on Community.
Dude, we can do several shows on Community because that show is so good.
Maybe we can try our hardest to get Dan Harmon on.
Oh, dude, we should. And we should get the whole cast on. Why not?
So.
There you go, yeah, man.
Right? There you go. That's so a show. From Matt Hawkins to Dan Harmon, that's a show. Oh, we're such dorks. Matt, thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate it. Gonna reach out because we'd love to have you on again. All right, everybody. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, I had nothing. No.
All right, everybody. That is a show. And I want to thank you for coming in and listening and being a part of this. If you liked what you heard, you want to hear more with a plethora of amazing guests, then go over to spoilerverse.com and check out all our past episodes. We also have a ton of other podcasts for you to check out.
We do. And we have articles. We have previews. We have thought pieces. We have articles on paranormal. I mean, there's so much. There's like 13, 14 podcasts. There's a bunch of people writing articles coming out all the time. So go to spoilerverse.com, check it all out. And while you're there, click on that store link, go to our store, pick up a t-shirt or something. Help us out a little bit. You know, we get a little bit of money for that. Helps us pay the bills to keep this crazy roller coaster going.
There you guys go. All right, guys, we are out. But don't forget, in an oceans of podcasts,
we are Cthulhu.
And as Cthulhu compels you to do,
open the mind.
Read more.
That's a good one. War. It's all flat.
Read more.